instead of what we were promised, we got something quite different. Now, if you look at the Republicans, right, with Boehner and the House Tea Party majority, they ran talking about jobs, 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 but instead when they got in, it was tax cuts for the rich and their strange ideas about social policy. So I think we have to ask, is a bait and switch in progress here, where Ron Paul talks about peace and opposition to dictatorship and totalitarianism on the home front, but instead we seem to be getting a draconian, brutal series of budget cuts. And one or two other things about this. There is the Davis-Bacon Act, landmark legislation, and what it prescribes is that if you have a federal construction project, then that has to pay union wages. It's called the prevailing wage standard. And prevailing wage is interpreted to mean union wages, union pay scales. So you're not going to get a federal construction job and then be expected to work for the federal minimum wage. It's significantly higher. If you wipe out the Davis-Bacon Act, then this essentially destroys a whole series of trade unions. And the savings on this, $6 billion, but at the same time, look at the social impact, right? The trade unions would cease to exist. The combination of Ron Paul, the father, and Senator Rand Paul, the son, right, senator from Kentucky, what they both want to do is to change the Taft-Hartley law, which currently governs union policies, at least at the federal level. They want to change that so that instead of having a state's right to choose to be a union state, or to put it the other way, instead of having some states that have chosen to be right-to-work states where organizing unions is almost impossible, this is the Southern Belt in general, the Rand Paul and Ron Paul too, they want to essentially have a compulsion at the federal level that everybody has to be a right-to-work state. So between the...
Well, that's a good union issue there, Taft-Hartley and right-to-work. Sorry, I ran over there. I didn't know I had the theme installed. I won't do that announcement. That's a great announcement. That sounds pretty truthy to me, to use a term from another milieu or another medium. No, actually, I just heard that this guy has got some history. But what I heard was sounds well-researched, and that's from Guns and Butter. It's a WBAI show. You can find it at Archive BAI. I think they also put their stuff up on radioforall.net, which the Illinois World Labor Hour does as well. Okay, and maybe that's where I'll get this next impending 2 hours so I can slew through it. And not listen to all of it. Anyway, thanks for listening and support WEFT.
We're just not working. Hello, folks, and welcome to the January 21st, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and webcast worldwide at weft.org. And, as usual, we just want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed during this 2 hours of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the Unemployed and Underemployed Helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. It's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And Tom's poem for this week from his Cries for Justice manuscript is An Ode to Occupiers. Also with us here today is co-founder of the show, Bill Gorell, and we're hoping to have Carl Estbrook in the studio a little bit later, and phone-in, friend of the show from Oakland, California, John Ryman, and I believe David Johnson, normal host of the Illinois World Labor Hour, will be showing up here shortly.
He's at a Jobs for Justice meeting.
He's at a Jobs for Justice meeting. So now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
The Associated Press in Washington, D.C. reports that the national economy is off to a fast start for 2012. The outlook for hiring is promising as applications for unemployment benefits are nearing a four-year low. Adding to that optimism, inflation is remaining low, business travel is up, and the homes market is showing slight gains after three dismal years. This data followed other reports indicating that the economy did begin 2012 with vitality. Companies are hiring more, consumer confidence is up, more people are buying cars, and factories are making more goods. Even bank lending, which all but froze during the depths of the financial crisis, is on the rise. However, many economists are cautioning that it is still too early to firmly conclude that the recovery is accelerating. Even with 6 months of solid job growth, the rate of unemployment remains painfully high at 8.5 nationwide. Housing is still slowing the economic recovery, inflation-adjusted wages fell over the past year, and recession in Europe could very possibly weaken growth here eventually.
Thanks, Tom. Well, I guess that is sort of good news there. All right. On February 24th, Daniel Lopez is going to lose his job. Daniel works in a warehouse in Mira Loma, California, moving goods for Walmart day in and day out. With what he's paid for unloading 100-pound boxes from containers in the broiling heat, Daniel supports his four young children, two daughters, and two sons. He works extremely long hours, usually 6 days a week, yet still is paid only poverty wages for this grueling work. He has no holidays, sick days, or health insurance. In September 2011, Daniel Lopez and some of his co-workers filed a federal lawsuit against the operator of his warehouse for not paying them enough to meet the minimum requirements of U.S. wage laws, including not paying the minimum wage for all hours worked and not paying overtime compensation. In the lawsuit, Daniel and his co-workers offered detailed accounts of how they received zero compensation for many hours worked, were denied breaks despite dangerous heat and long hours, and received zero overtime compensation despite working 7-day weeks and 16-hour and longer work days during the high season. At the same time that Daniel and his co-workers filed this lawsuit, the Department of Labor Standards Enforcement in California conducted an inspection of the facility, resulting in more than $600,000 in citations for record-keeping violations alone. Daniel and his co-workers talked to the government investigators during the inspection. Soon after, Daniel and his co-workers were threatened, harassed, and finally told all 70 of them would be losing their jobs on February 24th for standing up for their basic rights. Daniel and his co-workers are being rewarded with a pink slip. Walmart should solve this problem by adopting a responsible contractor policy that would obligate the contractors it does business with to observe certain standards that protect workers. There's a petition online. You can go to www.change.org/petitions and then look for Stand with Daniel Lopez to tell Walmart to stop abusing warehouse workers. And this petition demands that Walmart, the largest employer in the U.S., ensure that warehouse workers who move Walmart goods are paid a living wage, make sure they have safe, steady, full-time jobs with benefits, and guarantee their legal rights are respected. Daniel is standing up for his rights so he can take care of his kids. Let's stand up with him. This is similar to the story we talked about a little bit last week with Apple and the subcontractors and stuff like that. And yeah. Bill Gorrell brought up a very interesting opinion last week that many of these companies do it so that they can just say, well, we're doing our share and we can't control what our subcontractors are doing.
Yeah, it's like an arm's length situation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, we didn't know that was going on. Oh, no.
Exactly. Anyway, Tom, you got another story there?
Yeah. Kraft Foods Incorporated has roughly 127,000 employees worldwide, including 46,500 in North America. However, Kraft will be cutting 1,600 positions in North America as it proceeds to split its business in two. But the cuts announced are not likely to directly affect any jobs at Kraft's manufacturing facility in Champaign, which employs some 1,350 people. The cuts are being focused on sales, corporate, and business unit areas, and not manufacturing. How manufacturing will be affected by the company split into two separate companies, a global snacks business and a North American grocery business, has yet to be determined. According to Joyce Hodell, a company spokesperson, Kraft will continue its ongoing review of its manufacturing facilities to ultimately consider what will be best for both new companies. At this point in time, Kraft has not cut any jobs at its manufacturing facilities, but the company's statements indicate that with the pending split, it will be deeply reviewing this part of its businesses to determine what is best for both new companies. As far as local Kraft employees are concerned, they are safe for now, but they are going to need to keep their fingers crossed.
Yeah, I got a story here from Huffington Post about the Goldman Sachs bonus day bloodbath.
Yeah,
reports are creeping out that yesterday's bonus day wasn't all fun and games at America's most iconic investment bank. Goldman's profits fell in 2011. Ooh, right. In the final quarter alone by as much as 58% from the same period a year later. I guess they were just doing that much better at robbing the world's people.
The year before,
Yeah. As a result, the investment bank set aside 21% less for compensation and benefits.
So they made 58% less profits, but they only set aside 21% less for bonuses?
Yeah, apparently. I'm glad I don't have any stock in Goldman Sachs. Anyway, here's a quote here from a mid-level Goldman Sachs employee. It's a bloodbath. One girl was actually crying, I think.
She wasn't going to get $1 million bonus?
Well, see, here's the thing, though, and this is like a lot of stuff, sort of like sports teams. You find out, why are they going on strike? This guy makes $20 million a year. Yeah, well, this other dude's that's sitting the bench and getting his ass beat in practice all the time. He's, getting $100,000, and he's only got a few years. And then what's he going to do? Okay. But anyway, some first-year Goldman analysts received $40,000 bonuses. Okay, that's probably more than I made last year working.
Right, yeah.
It's
more than I made last year.
Well, I do have one of the best part-time jobs in the world.
One I've made for the last several years.
Yeah. And some second-year analysts received bonuses between $40,000 and $56,000. But the thing is, these are, you know, might be half of their compensation for the year. So it is a pretty big chunk. And when you consider they're probably living in New York City, you know, what's your rent going to be somewhere, you know? These people are, I mean, these little people down low on the totem pole are getting beat pretty hard with this. You know, unfortunately, they're not organized and they don't have a contract that says they should be getting good money anyway. And they're relying on these bonuses.
It's a bloodbath, Bill.
Yeah, it's a bloodbath. But when you get up to the top here, that's another story. Now, it says here that Morgan Stanley, another investment bank, limited bonuses for both junior and senior employees by capping them at $125,000. And Credit Suisse is no longer giving junior bankers automatic pay jumps. And on top of this, Goldman slashed 2,400 jobs last year. So, folks, it sounds like it's not good to work for these guys either. It's like everything else. They're workers, too.
Yeah.
And the people at the top are going to take advantage of them whenever they get a chance.
Right. And the people that are really doing a lot of the work are getting screwed.
Right. And like everywhere else, even though they might think, oh, boy, I'm an investment banker. Yeah.
Yeah. Story out of Wisconsin that we've been following for a year now. The governor who took on the unions may face a closely watched recall election. Critics of Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin submitted to the state on Tuesday more than 1 million signatures, nearly twice as many as required on recall petitions against him, to force a new election. State election officials now begin the arduous, expensive process of studying the petition for flaws and duplicated names. But leaders of the recall effort said the number of signatures was so large as to put any serious legal challenge out of reach. The anti-Walker forces needed 540,000 names and had estimated they would produce about 720. So this still larger number of over 1 million came as a surprise to many. Barring a legal fight, Mr. Walker, a Republican who took office a year ago and set off a firestorm by curtailing collective bargaining rights for public workers, will face a new election in the late spring or early summer. Around the country, only two governors have ever been removed through recall. It says here that while this was going on, Mr. Walker was attending a fundraiser in New York on Tuesday. But he'd said earlier that a recall election appeared inevitable.
Yeah, so. I tell you what, man, right there, there's several hundred thousand people pointing or showing their middle finger to Scott Walker.
Yeah.
You know, and I had some communication with a conservative friend of mine over this, and over on that side, it's, half the signatures are Mickey Mouse or, you know, Adolf Hitler.
Mickey's old enough to vote.
You know. Yeah, he's been around for 70 years.
You know,
years.
But I mean, there's... It's just ridiculous. And also, too, he was voted in an election.
Right. And before he deserves to stay for
four. And before the Republicans got in, all the Democrats were doing all this terrible procedural crap to the Republicans all the time, you know. Well, I don't know. Maybe the Republicans should have had a recall.
Maybe.
Of the Democrats, if they didn't like that. And number two, the law's there. It's a recall. It wasn't some law that was just voted in only for Scott Walker or anybody else. I don't know when this law came up, but it could have been used.
I heard that one thing that's different, I mean, because I remember Governor Gray getting recalled out in California.
Right.
And they said that there was actually two separate votes in that one. One to recall the existing governor
and
another
one
to elect a replacement.
Yeah. I was wondering about that.
Apparently, in Wisconsin, it's going to be all in one election. So
there'll be somebody running against them.
That's what it sounded like, yeah. So I'll have to do some further research that you're going to vote to recall him and put somebody else in his place. So
yeah, because there's also a recall, I believe, against the lieutenant governor.
Yes.
But I want to say right now that this is just spitting in the face of fighting Bob La Follette.
Yes,
the
right.
Founder of the Progressive magazine, who, by the way, was a Republican.
Yes.
And also another famous Republican, John L. Lewis.
Yes, yes.
Amazingly enough. Of course, there's some things about John L. Lewis that weren't fantastic. But, you know, it's really interesting when people like that. And look at Teddy Roosevelt. Look at Abraham Lincoln. You know,
yes,
there is no capital without labor. Labor is always...
Right.
You know, and these people are just, I mean, I'm sorry, man.
Right.
Both
parties have lost sight of what they really stood for.
That is true, but the Republicans are just so over they're talking about stuff, maybe it's because I'm getting so old, but they're talking about things now that that nobody would even have brought up
in the 1970s. You're still young at heart,
it's just amazing. I can't believe it.
You're absolutely right here. It says petitions were also submitted on Tuesday for recall elections of the lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clefish, and they had 845,000 recall signatures on that, and also four Republican state senators, including Scott Fitzgerald, who's the majority leader who helped pass Mr. Walker's collective bargaining cuts.
And here's another thing, too, and I was looking for some of this video the other day, but I couldn't find it. I can't think of the keywords that would get me to it. There was a lot of harassment, abuse, and pretty much violence against people collecting signatures.
Oh, really?
Yes. That was all over my Facebook anyway.
Yeah.
You know, people, you know, stopping and getting out of their cars and going up and like yanking petitions out of people's hands. And there were, assault charges filed against at least one person.
Let's go to a little bit of Workers Independent News here. I think they also talk a little bit about the recall in Wisconsin, and then we're going to quickly go to...
Yeah, I hope this isn't the one where the representative from the Laborers International Union criticizes Obama for canceling the Keystone XL pipeline because it's going to cost thousands of jobs. Hey, man, laborers can work on wind farms too, not just pipelines. And I'm somebody who has a pipeline qualification from the union to work on pipelines. And I'm really glad that the one pipeline I wanted to work on didn't come through because it was going to be carrying that tar sands oil.
Yeah, and that's dirty stuff. So we'll go to Workers Independent News and then briefly a little bit of Hightower News, and we'll be back with Tom's poem on the Cultural Corner.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans in Indiana continue efforts to ram through so-called right-to-work legislation that would weaken worker rights to form and sustain unions. The Indiana AFL-CIO's Jeff Harris says despite huge Republican majorities in the legislature, the anti-union legislation may still fail.
There are a number of Republicans in both the House and State Senate who are opposed to the right to work for less, and they have come out publicly as well. So the vote is still incredibly close. I think in the House of Representatives, where there's 100 members and it's a 60-40 partisan split, I think it'll come down to one or two votes. And in the State Senate, where there's 50 votes, 37 of them are Republican and 13 are Democrats, it's also going to be within one or two votes. It's really an economic issue. Who's standing with working men and women and who's standing with corporations?
A poll shows 71% of Hoosiers want to vote a referendum on the issue instead of the legislature deciding it. The NFL Players Association is against the anti-union legislation, and Republicans who back it are trying to get it passed before the Super Bowl is held in Indianapolis. The NFL Players Association has been more active than usual when it comes to supporting workers in other industries. Jesse Russell reports.
Earlier this month, a group of players challenged the Indiana legislature to not pass right-to-work legislation. And this week, the executive director of the association, DeMaurice Smith, sent a strongly worded letter to Cooper Tire expressing concern with the treatment of workers at a Findlay, Ohio plant, where the workers are locked out. Smith wrote that the association is proud to support the many workers at Cooper Tire who are defying wage-cutting demands, and that he looks forward to the day Cooper Tire meets a standard of living wages, dignity, and respect. The employees have been locked out of the plant since December 13th.
The Labor Network for Sustainability's Joe Uline says the Obama administration's decision to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline project is encouraging. Uline says the proponents of the pipeline are arguing a false choice, that the pipeline project is a choice between jobs or the environment. Uline says labor must come to grips with environmental sustainability, and it's urgent and essential that we begin seriously investing in an environmentally sustainable economy that provides the jobs that we all need. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The powers that be constantly try to pull the wool over people's eyes. But sometimes the wool blinders are so itchy that people rip them off and clearly see the scam. One of the itchiest ever is the Kafkaesque fiction put forth by America's right-wing power establishment that corporations are persons with the constitutional right to control our elections with their bottomless troves of corporate cash. This is an absurd perversion of nature itself. A person, after all, has a navel. Where's the corporate navel? Or its heart, brain, or soul? Also, if a corporation is a person, shouldn't it be subject to frontline military duty, to jail for its criminal violations, and even to the death penalty? As a listener pointed out to me in a recent email, many states do not allow persons under 18 years of age to marry, or, in corporate terminology, to merge. Plus, such young persons are subject to curfews and cannot legally be served alcohol. If you see a young corporation violating any of these teen laws, call the cops on them. When a corporate and governmental cabal makes such a power play that the very idea of it becomes a national joke, both the idea and the cabal are in trouble. That's the case with a comical claim of personhood for corporations. All across the country, beneath the radar of America's clueless elites, a savvy and scrappy grassroots coalition is mobilizing to overturn the anti-democratic effort by the Supreme Court, corporate front groups, and political sellouts to enthrone corporate money over the people. On January 20th and 21st, there will be two national days of action to rally public support for a constitutional amendment to reject the farce of corporate personhood. This is Jim Hightower saying, to join the rebellion, connect with www.movetoamend.org and www.democracyisforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
All right, now we've come to that part of the program here on WEFT, Champaign 90.1 FM. It's a Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner, and this week Tom's poem is An Ode to Occupiers.
Who is now speaking loud enough for folks from coast to hear? They're being called occupiers as they stand for what they hold dear. Occupiers are occupants of a land that belongs to them, with laws and a constitution and freedom that is not a whim. Occupiers are citizens. They are the ones who built our land because Wall Street has cheated them. They're folks who chose to take a stand. A stand against sneaking gangsters, bankers who buy politicians, who tax the poor and struggling, not improving their conditions. But change perhaps is on the way, now that so many people stood, to put some control on Wall Street, to make our economy good. The more of us who stand and march, who camp out in the public park, the more politicians may see that our cause is not just a lark. Support the patriots marching, because they're doing it for you. They are demanding that justice become a concept that is true. An Ode to Occupiers was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on November 14, 2011, and was brought to you live today, January 21, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
All right, I'll give you a couple of public service announcements here, and then we're going to be changing some microphones around and doing some stuff here. Don't forget, you can tune in Sunday, this Sunday and every Sunday at 4 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, cable channel Comcast, cable channel 6. And that brings you Labor's View TV show, hosted by our own David Johnson and friend of the show, Jim Iman. That's Sunday at 4 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, channel 6. And want to send you a reminder that WEFT is going to present a Bluegrass Roots Old Time and Honky Tonk and More extravaganza. That's going on Sunday, January 29th, 5 to 9 p.m. at the Iron Post in Urbana. That's going to feature Old Number 7, Strings Attached, Black Ridge Road, and the Big Blue Stem String Band. That's a fundraiser. All proceeds go to benefit WEFT 90.1 FM, and they're asking for a $10 donation. That says four bands for $10. No kidding, you know. And
that's $200. That's $2.50 a band.
That's a good deal.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, and also at the end of this month, we're going to start our annual radio food drive announcement. WEFT and Eastern Illinois Food Bank, our community partners for our 2012 radio food drive, beginning Monday, January 30th. And for every $10 donated to the station, WEFT will in turn donate $1 to the food bank, which is then used to purchase $10 worth of food.
You know, man, our union used to be in that food bank until we had the until the International came in and put us in receivership for anti-democratic practices. That's anti-small d democratic.
Yeah.
And anyway, the thing is, we're not a 501c. A union is not a 501c.
Oh, really?
Organization, no. And so it was actually illegal for union locals to be distribution points for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
So you couldn't help them out anymore.
Yeah.
We're going to go to a brief little thing here. This is a
okay. What do you got?
I got a little track from the Austin Lounge Lizards.
Can I play this Mitt Romney thing?
Is it ready to go?
Yeah, it's on. I got it queued up on auxiliary.
Yeah, on aux. Yeah, go ahead. We should be ready, Bill.
Okay. Apparently.
Well, I hope I get a chance to talk about the topic you began with. We'll come back to the direct attack from Speaker Gingrich in a moment. So let's go back and talk about first what you.
That's
a
reference to
course,
Gingrich talking about vulture capitalism.
About our tax code that's out of alignment with other nations. We've spoken about the fact that regulation is overwhelming us, that we need to take care of our energy resources and become energy secure. We have to open up markets, and we have to crack down on China when they cheat. But I'd like to talk about something else that President Obama has been doing. He's been practicing crony capitalism. And if you want to get America going again, you've got to stop the spread of crony capitalism. He gives General Motors to the UAW. He takes $500 million and sticks it into Solyndra. He stacks the labor stooges on the NLRB so they can say no to Boeing and take care of their friends in the labor movement. You go across the country with regards to energy, because he has to bow to the most extreme members of the environmental movement. He turns down the Keystone Pipeline, which would bring energy and jobs to America. This president is the biggest impediment to job growth in this country, and we have to replace Barack Obama to get America working again.
Okay, folks, back to the Labor Stooges hour. Man, I tell you, these people are just beyond the pale. You know what? I bet there is 10% of union members in the United States that would vote for that man.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk to people all the time. I can't believe it, man. The old Reagan Democrats. And then, now here's an observation I have. That's kind of strange. I think there's something weird going on with the Republican Party. Did you notice Rick Santorum? When isn't there? But did you notice Rick Santorum, all of a sudden, he won the Iowa caucus? And
yeah, they also changed that.
Yeah, and on the big religious summit in Texas this week or last week, they came out for for Rick Santorum instead of Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Or Rick Perry. And
did
I was
they
reading
know Perry was going to pull out by that time?
No, they didn't. But here's the thing. I was reading an article about it, and apparently there was two or three different votes on this thing, and they said, like, the Catholics just kind of took everything over and said, to hell with what really happened. This is, you know, who we're backing. And I'm looking at it like, well, you know, Newt Gingrich is bringing up all this stuff about Mitt Romney's background in business, and he's making capitalism look really bad.
Yep.
Meanwhile, Rick Santorum's up there, and I was watching him the other night. Every other word out of his mouth is worker. And he's talking, it's worker this, worker that, worker this, worker that. And then at the very end, you know, the thing that he prescribes for the country to do is just another trickle-down thing that you've heard for decades. Oh, we got to cut taxes for work, you know, and it's just ridiculous. And I think they're positioning Santorum because both Gingrich and Romney have too much baggage. Even though I couldn't believe, I mean, Gingrich has gonads, man. I could not believe how he reacted to John King the other night. What? What? You say anything about my affairs? How dare you bring that up? You know, like, wow, you would think the guy would go for the, you know, forgiveness, you know, but he just went right, just was like, I mean, crazy. And then the other night when Juan Williams, formerly of NPR, now of Fox, asked him about the food stamp thing, he's going, no. In this sort of like real petulant voice, like, how dare you question me, black man? You know, I these people, wow. And then the crowd's like going wild. You know, it's like at a rock concert or something. I'm surprised they're not all giving the, oh, yeah, that's right, they're Christians. They wouldn't be given that devil sign. But, you know, I'm surprised they're not lighting lighters. And it's just crazy, man. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, this is beyond the pale. It's completely, this, in my lifetime, this reminds me a whole lot of George Wallace. You know, I don't know, man.
Well, Bill, thanks, guys, for holding down the fort and everything. And I think this is a great lead-in to this discussion debate that we're going to be having here in about 5 minutes with Carl Estabrook, who's in the studio with us. Welcome, Carl. And John Ryman, who will be calling in from Oakland, California. But, you know, I'll tell you what, Bill. You know who the corporate money's behind. I mean, it's of course, Romney. But what's interesting about Santorum is he just came out of nowhere. You know, all of a sudden he got an endorsement from.
Well, that's what I'm saying, man.
Yes.
I think that the Republican establishment's getting scared about blowing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would rather lose the presidency than have. Because Gingrich, I mean, he is such a loose cannon, and if you cross him, he'll do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing it now. I mean, can you believe this documentary that he released in South Carolina about what Rick Perry was calling vulture capitalism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a sign of the times when one Republican attacks another one about what he did to workers. I mean, I think we have the Occupy movement to, you know,
and
credit for that.
Romney's the milk bottle child of, you know, this capitalism. And then he turns everything on its head, starts talking about crony capitalism. I mean, they just, you know, that was really a term that was coined for places like Indonesia or something. And it's the same thing, like using outsourcing instead of offshoring. Entitlements. All of this language stuff. And that was something that Newt was big on in the 90s.
Yeah, I think the corporate elites, they want a contest between Obama and
1984 doublespeak, man. It's the Ministry of Truth.
Yes. They want the corporate elite want a contest between Obama and Romney because those are the two corporate candidates. And I think a lot of this on the Republican side is theater to make Romney look good. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it unless there's really that many nutcases out there. I couldn't believe I saw Santorum actually attack Romney the other day over the recent enabling law that was passed by the Obama and the Congress, the Military Detention Act, where Romney was asked if he supported. He goes, well, I think President Obama did the right thing on this. And he was attacked by Santorum, and Santorum is defending the right to trial and evidence and habeas corpus. I mean, it's just, I'll tell you, it's just really strange. Of course, they're looking for any little thing to attack the other one on. I mean, that's a lot of it, of course, opportunism. Well,
yeah, but what I'm saying is I think they're afraid that if they do go ahead with Romney, and that it will help change the zeitgeist to be more anti-capitalist
mm-hmm.
because of what he represents, the form of capitalism that he represents, and he would be taking a pounding for months on that. You know that the Democrats would be all over that.
Well, but they want Obama to win re-election. I mean, that's the bottom line. Look where the money. Follow the money, man. Obama's got over $1 billion already.
Well, the overall establishment, yes. It doesn't matter to them. But I'm talking about the Republican establishment.
And there's even different wings within the Republican establishment, you know, the Christian right and et cetera.
I'm thinking, too, that is a 60s word that needs to be revived is the establishment.
Yeah.
Because look at the time it came out of. Well, people didn't like Johnson because of the war, but the Republicans were jerks, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was the establishment.
Yes. Okay, I think John Ryman is going to be calling here real soon here. I just want to basically read this public service announcement real quick. Truck Stop for the Long Haul, which is on January 27th through 29th at the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway. A convergence for those who feel that Occupy 99% is a powerful, empowering movement and who want time, tools, and new ideas to figure out what now, what next. There'll be presentations, small group discussions, skill shares, process shares, problem shares, and all varieties and levels of experience are welcome. And for more information, you can contact designingasociety.net. And again, that's the convergence for the Occupy movement here on January 27th to 29th at the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway, downtown Urbana. Okay, I'm going to play a little song here real quick while we're waiting. This song is basically really old. This was contributed by Jim Iman, and it's from the Henry Wallace campaign in 1948, and it's called Election...
Henry Wallace?
Yes.
Maybe,
the third party candidate that ran against Harry Truman.
That's right.
And
yeah, he was
Dewey.
Formerly a vice president of Roosevelt, too, wasn't he?
I believe so. Yes, he was also agricultural secretary.
He was to the left
secretary.
Of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, and then we'll get off here as soon as John calls in.
And it means my life. It can bring a higher wage. It can pension my old age. It can make a little home for kids and wife.
Kids and wife.
The Republicans, they grieve me. The Democrats only deceive me. I have a brand new party, believe me. And we are rolling up the...
Hello, Yanir.
Hi, David, this is John Ryman calling.
Okay, John, thanks for calling in and everything. We were just playing a little song that was contributed by Jim Iman from the Henry Wallace campaign back in 1948, and we thought it would be a good way to start this discussion debate, basically about electoral politics, particularly Ron Paul campaign and the workers' movement. So I guess why don't we just start off by having both you and Carl kind of introduce yourselves and give brief background of what you're all about. We'll start with you, John.
Okay. Well, I'm a retired carpenter, and I was expelled from the Carpenters Union for leading a wildcat strike as well as other activities. And I'm a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and I'm on the General Executive Board of the IWW. I should also say that what I'm speaking on today and the views that I express are my views. I'm not representing the views of the IWW in this discussion.
Okay, very good. And Carl?
Carl Esterbrook. I'm a retired college teacher, university faculty member in history. And related disciplines, I've, like John, I've been expelled, too. I've been kicked off 3 university faculties in the course of my somewhat checkered career. and I was kicked out of WEFT, too, because I started 20 years ago the program News from Neptune here with Paul Muth. And in a dispute a year or so ago when I insisted on having equal time on that program, WEFT decided it didn't want to honor my historical position in that program. So I took the program to local television, cable television, and News from Neptune can be seen now on Urbana Public Television Friday evenings at 7 o'clock and repeated throughout the week.
Okay, John, why don't we start off with you?
Also, Ed, I should say also that I'm a lifelong socialist.
Okay, very good.
And I can say the same thing, depending upon when you want to begin the life, so to speak. For me, it started with an association with Noam Chomsky. The socialism that I embrace is sort of yellow dog Chomskyanism, libertarian socialism in the old European sense, not in the modern sense of libertarian.
American definition. Okay.
Right, exactly.
Okay, John, we'll start with you here. Why don't we start with the whole tactic, idea, if you will, of electoral politics. I guess I'll let you just start wherever you want on that, because there's different aspects of that we could even go into. But why don't you just talk a little bit about what your views on electoral politics are and how you see it as either an end or a means.
Well, you know, there's some people on the left, like in the Occupy movement and so on, who basically say that electoral politics are outmoded or irrelevant. But the problem is that for the great majority of American workers, they don't see it as such. And in fact, I mean, if there were ever a move to eliminate popular elections in this country, there would be massive outrage against that. And so the way I see it is electoral politics are a massive forum in which ideas are debated. And as the Wall Street Journal has said in the past, ideas matter. Unfortunately, with the current American electoral scene, the only ideas that are debated to any significance are the ideas of the capitalist class. And there needs to be the ideas of the working class and the anti-capitalist ideas that are also put forward in this forum.
Okay, and Carl?
Look, first of all, I want to say I think that's exactly the right place to start with the consideration of electoral politics, and I agree almost entirely with what John said on the nature of electoral politics. I'd want to stress the extent to which electoral politics are a way, a ruling class method for missing the point, eh? That the point of electoral politics from the point of view of our rulers is that it's a containment strategy. It's kettling. Instead of really talking about the condition of the American economy after the crash and what should be done now, we're told, no, get excited about some peculiar people called Gingrich and Santorum and so forth, and in a year or so we'll have an election, and then these things can be worked out. Well, you know, we can't wait. I mean, we shouldn't wait, and we should recognize, all of us, that the electoral system is a system for putting the lid on real political complaints. Now, it's particularly important this year because real political complaints have broken out, most notably in the Occupy movement, which has raised the issue of class again in American politics. But it's also broken out in other ways, too. I think we make a big mistake if we see the Tea Party movement as only an AstroTurf campaign. The Tea Party movement worries our rulers, and that's why they've made so many efforts to reincorporate it, to suture it back into the system. That's what the Obama administration is doing right now for the Occupy movement. The danger is the containment vessel is cracked, that electoral politics, which is supposed to contain these political dismays and turn them aside, isn't working. And all our rulers are working overtime to make sure that the lid can be put back on, that things can be put back in there, the toothpaste can go back in the tube, and it's not clear they're going to be able to do it.
John, what do you view of this elections this time? Now, I know you've been a strong advocate of forming a workers' party because you, like myself, and I think pretty much everybody here in this room, realize that really we live in a one-party state, and there's basically two parties, two wings of that party. And so, for the long haul, for the long term, you're advocating some kind of workers' party or labor party. So in that context, do you see this particular election cycle, this 2012, as particularly dismal, interesting, or how would you describe it?
Well, it's clear that a lot of the contradictions and a lot of the conflicts in American society are starting to come more to the surface. And you've had, for one thing, you've had the a wing of the capitalist class has fostered like the right-wing evangelicals and so on as a means of diverting the class struggle. And they've done this, that was basically the Republican, the Southern strategy that was started under Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is that that's become something of a Frankenstein monster for them. Not completely. I mean, it's something that they use, but it's not completely under their control. And that's what's starting to come to the surface in the Republican primaries, where you have these people, well, you see he just dropped out, Rick Perry, but also others who are playing to that. And Ron Paul is, too, to a great extent. Of course, he supports, you know, a Christian state and that sort of thing. But they also, they need to use that as a threat, as a potential threat, as a club to be kept in reserve in case or for whenever the class struggle really more decisively breaks out into the open. And then they will put more resources and more direct support into that wing.
Okay, Carl?
I'm just going to say that I think that I haven't heard anything I disagree with here about what's going on, but I am saying that for our purposes, the question we have to ask is whether we're going to bother with electoral politics at all once we realize that they're there to distract us from those real political issues, indeed from the authentic class struggle that has indeed emerged into consciousness. It was always there, of course, but has emerged into consciousness in American politics recently. I could think you could make a case for saying, look, don't spend any time thinking or talking or worrying about people named Gingrich and Santorum and Obama and whoever else, because it makes no difference. Matt Taibbi said we were going to watch one 1% stooge take on another 1% stooge in the election. That seems to me to be about right. And the whole purpose of it is to distract our attention.
Well, I don't think it's correct to say that electoral politics are simply there to distract us. If you look, for instance, just at how our so-called founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, who were all either slave owners or basically bankers, what they were discussing when they wrote the Constitution, their first desire actually was to establish a monarchy with George Washington as the king. But they realized that they'd never be able to get that through, and so they had to, as a concession to the masses, at least of white people in this country, they had to agree to popular elections, a modified form of popular elections. And I'm not saying that fundamental change in society, that is to say the overthrow of capitalism and the establishment of socialism, that that can be done through bourgeois or capitalist elections. No, it can't. But the capitalist elections are part of the like the public forum in the United States in which ideas can be debated. And in fact, I mean, it's just simply not true to say that nothing can be changed through elections. If you look at what you have in Western Europe, where you have, everybody knows, you have a far wider social safety network. And how was that achieved? It was achieved through the bourgeois elections and through the establishment of mass workers' parties in those countries. So I just don't think that that's right. I don't, just to repeat, I don't have illusions in what the capitalist elections can do as far as fundamentally transforming society. But to just simply label them as a distraction is also not accurate, I think.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that, John. I think that's right. I was saying a case could be made for ignoring electoral politics entirely because its primary purpose is to prevent political expression on the part of the majority.
Primary purpose. That's not true.
Well, fine. That is indeed the way it's being used by our rulers right now. That's the reason that we'll have a Romney versus Obama election. That's the reason the elections are about personalities. You know as well as I do that if we had an election about policies in this country rather than personalities, we get very different results. 80% of Americans support something like single-payer health care. Unions have, in theory, have a majority support in this country. A winning candidate is very lucky to get 51%. Policies, however, are overwhelmingly approved by the electorate. Therefore, we need a system that takes that markets candidates like toothpaste. I don't know why toothpaste is on my mind today. It seems to be coming up. Yeah, that markets candidates this way in order to prevent the real expression of the majority's opinion, as you say quite rightly about the formation of the Constitution. The Constitution was set up to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Said James Madison, the primary drafter of the Constitution. That really hasn't changed. That's what elections are supposed to do now. But, you know, this is in some sense a red herring. I mean, we both agree that electoral politics should be attended to. Then the question becomes, what are you going to do in electoral politics right now? What should you do right now? Should you back Obama?
Well, the reason that electoral politics play the role that they do in the United States today is the absence of the voice of the working class. That is to say, the absence of any working class candidate or a mass working class political party. And so if we agree on that, then it's exactly during the time of public elections when you have to raise that issue and fight for that. And if you vote for, then you have to advocate others to vote for one capitalist candidate or another. And that means that exactly the time when you should be fighting for this idea of the worker's voice, you're capitulating to the voice of the capitalist class.
So your suggestion is that we shouldn't eschew electoral politics, but what we should actually do is propose